At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
CODA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
Unlocked, the real science of screen time and how to spend it better. Most of us spend a significant part of our day in front of a screen. Our work and social lives play out through our computers, tablets and phones. But what is all this screen time doing to our health, our sleep and our relationships? Professor Pete Etchells is the author of Unlocked and he joins us live on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is indeed all mine. We've heard all sorts of reports and warnings and protestations of doom that we're becoming zombies to the screen. Should we be unduly worried, Pete?
So I think the answer there is yes and no. So it's definitely not the case that there's nothing to worry about. And I think it would be silly if anybody did suggest that. But I think we have a tendency when it comes to digital technologies to maybe focus on the wrong things. And, these are sort of very much driven by cycles of panic. And there's a lot of scaremongering in the news about them as well.
So what's the premise of Unlocked then? What made you decide to put this down and not on a tablet, but actually write it in the old fashioned way?
I really care about good science communication, and I've done a lot of research over the past 10 years or so into various forms of digital technologies and how they impact our well-being and how they impact our behavior and how we interact with them. And it's a really messy and a really complicated area of science for all sorts of reasons. But what we see in the research is very often not particularly well mirrored in the public conversations that we have about digital tech. So they very often are pretty much solely negative, very sensationalized. And it's understandable then that people really worry about them. But then when you look at the science behind some of those headlines, it's not as clear cut what's going on. So the point of this book really was just to try and reassure people a little bit more that, maybe some of the big things that we're persistently told to worry about, we shouldn't worry about as much. But here are some things that we maybe want to focus on. And here are some tools and ways of thinking or rethinking our technology behaviors that might help us a little bit more with those relationships.
One of the things that's leveled at our screens, our screen time, be it computers, be it on a large computer, my brain's completely gone today, or on your tablet or on your screen, is the fact that it has cut into our attention spans. We do not spend time, we react rather than taking a pause and thinking about stuff. And we don't, why watch a half an hour documentary when you can watch a 50-second TikTok?
Yeah. It's a criticism that gets leveled quite a lot, right? But at the same time, one of the most highly rated box office smashing movies of the past 5 or 6 years was like over 3 hours long, right? So there's this weird paradoxical thing going on in a lot of these debates that everybody focuses on things like social media and the fact that we get these 15, 20 second segments and therefore our attention spans must be collapsing. But that's not reflected in the way that we consume media and culture more generally, right? So and one of my favorite examples of this is that, so there's this trope, and I talk about it in the book, that we have an attention span that's shorter than a goldfish, right? And I love this. It's a zombie statistic, yeah. Right? It's not based on anything. Everything about it's wrong. It's usually like goldfish have 9 second attention spans and we have an 8 second attention span. Neither of those facts are true, but it keeps cropping up.
Right.
And like literally year on year, my favorite one was a couple of years ago was I think the NBA, the National Basketball Association in the US, was considering reducing the amount of time that games took because millennials' attention spans are collapsing. And it's just nonsense. But I think one of the problems that we see is that we're constantly bombarded with this as an idea, and it fits with our lived experience, right? We all feel frazzled. We all feel as though our attention's being distracted and stretched around from left, right, and center. So when somebody comes along and says your attention's collapsed, we take that uncritically. But there's a weird thing that happens in psychology research where it suggests that when you're presented with these sorts of things, regardless of whether or not you believe it or not to begin with, if you're repeatedly presented with it, you start to absorb it into your worldview. So it's this like idea of the influence of presumed influence. And I think because we're persistently told that our attention span is getting worse, then we start to feel that and it starts to become more salient.
And isn't this is the case that, you know, you just mentioned the M word, the millennials, and there's a shudder going through the spines of anybody below the age of so-and-so. And then we get Gen Z, even bigger shudder. But you think about this and think, oh, well, they've got no attention spans. And there's a, and I think it's quite funny because it pops up on my social media. There's a very, you know, it's a bunch of students in front of The Night Watchman by Rembrandt, Rembrandt. And they're all on their screens and it's like, oh, where did our, you know, this is modern society. Nobody's, but then you think about somebody has posted this on social media. So therefore, physician, heal thyself. And two, we've always demonized. Because the baby boomers were getting demonized for rock and roll, which was the new thing, and nobody was listening to classical music. So this is nothing new. It's just repeating itself.
Yeah, absolutely. We see moral panics around new forms of technology through the ages. We saw it with newspapers when they first came out. I talk about the repeal of the paper tax in this book, which is a bit of a weird thing to talk about. But, you know, there's an analogy there that once we started getting mass-produced paperback books and magazines, everybody started worrying about the effects that this was going to have on people, particularly women and children. And, you know, you'd see cartoons in newspapers mothers with a massive stack of books just absorbed in them with kids crying in the background, you know, very similar to the sorts of imagery we see nowadays. We go through these panics quite a lot. And it's always the case that when we're in one of those panics, the question you get is, well, yeah, all of those other ones have been shown to have not been borne out. You know, we've been fine in the end. But is this the one that's different? The honest answer there is we don't know. We won't know until we're out of it. But it's certainly following the same sorts of patterns that we see with others.
I just love the idea of, oh, no, Mama, don't read. Please don't pick up the Penny Dreadful. You know, the children need to eat.
there's a sort of puritanical element to it, and there's very often a sort of misogynistic undertone as well, that, you know, once the masses have access to a given form of technology, it's women and children that are going to suffer the most because they don't know how to deal with it. And it's, you know, we see those sorts of conversations come up again through history, and we're seeing them with video games. We saw them 20 years ago, 10 years ago even, and we're seeing that with social media and screen time now.
Because if you remember the great outcry about video games and when like something like Grand Theft Auto came out, and it was like, oh, we're teaching our kids to be violent gangsters, and, you know, despite what you might read in the media, those of us who do still game in our 40s and 50s haven't yet gone out to commit any major crime. So therefore it's another moral panic. And also it is this thing, isn't it, because there is if you are spending time on the internet, then you can only be doing it for stupid reasons, or for titillating, or what Taylor Swift's doing. And for somebody who is that worst creature, an armchair historian, plus a history buff, plus who likes books, but has now and used to spend days in libraries and with the Encyclopedia Britannica at home, then the internet is quite bleeding wonderful. Because I will go down all sorts of rabbit holes, and you've got to put a large rope on me to get me back. And it's nothing to do with Taylor Swift or Ed Sheeran. It's to do with finding out about the Byzantines, for example.
Yeah, we saw that. There's a weird. So my background's in video games research. That's how I got into a lot of this sort of stuff. And you see some very paradoxical arguments there, right? So on the one hand, a lot of people go, "Well, video games, they're just for kids. They're just this childish pastime. They're like a baser form of entertainment." And then at the same time, you hold this view that they're really bad for kids. You know, societally, these are problematic. Violent video games drive aggression, things like that. And it's always been a curiosity for me that we can hold those two thoughts simultaneously almost. And it's made it very difficult to do research in the area as well, because you're constantly pushing against this sense that trying to understand the effects of video games, really understand what impact they have on us, is not seen as a legitimate science in a way. But it absolutely is if you want to answer those big societal questions. And the problem is that this stokes the flames of those panics, because what happens is you get very reactive research that, to be honest, isn't very good. And it shows these really big negative effects very often when you see new psychological research into a given form of digital technology. The effects that you see to begin with are very big, they're very negative. And then over time, as we get better at doing research in that area, we come up with better methods, better ways of doing the statistics and things, those effects dampen, or they go away, or sometimes they go in the opposite direction. So the whole thing about violent video games and aggression is a great example, because for decades, you know, apparently the science was clear cut that these two things are very much linked. I wrote a whole other book about this 5 years ago, so we could talk about this for hours. But you look at the sorts of the studies that they do to answer that question, and they have no bearing on reality effectively. And it's only in the past 4 or 5 years or so, really, that we've got some really good methodologies, really good scientific studies that are showing that actually this is not something that we need to worry about.
And you know, I will shoot back on that one, because as a 56-year-old who still games, okay, because I'm of that first generation. I remember having Skeet and Pong, you know, literally the black and white. You know, there were two games on the system. There was football with four bits, and there was tennis with two things, and then it was Atari, and then it was the Sega Mega Drive, okay? Mm-hmm. And then we go on to the first PlayStation, whatever. And everybody goes, oh, gaming, it's just silly and it's violent. But I can say several great times that I've had playing Sonic. I mean, I can still remember playing Sonic the Hedgehog with friends and Crash Bandicoot and having hysterical, and friends crashing over coffee tables playing Wii tennis. So it's not, and I'm still stuck, you know, as a, you know, a motor racing fan, I'm still stuck somewhere in the Gran Turismo universe. So therefore, you know, so there we go. So you got to, what about relate? But that's, I've done that with friends in real time. I.e. having parties every hanging and go at Crash Bandicoot with a few drinks involved. There is the thing though, but saying if you go onto the internet, and I suppose the pandemic had a massive effect on this as well, that you don't form real relationships because people don't go out anymore because they're just stuck in their little homes, or we were forced to be stuck in our little homes, and some of us still haven't really come out from there.
There's a great line of research that speaks to this, I think, that we have this sense that our online lives are very detached from our quote-unquote real-world offline lives, in that, you know, it feels like you can go onto the internet, you can be whoever you want to be, you can, you know, hide under cloaks of anonymity and things like that. And to a certain extent, those things are accurate. But there's this growing body of research at the minute that suggests that actually our online lives mirror our offline lives in quite important ways. And we tend very often to present authentic versions of ourselves online. And moreover, if you look at adolescent populations, teenage populations in particular, there are all these worries that they're going online and just talking to random strangers. But actually, most of the time, what they're doing is maintaining existing social networks online. So it's not so much that these two things are separate and they're different things. They become blended, and one is used to help and reinforce the other, and vice versa. I think we all got a sense of that over the pandemic, right? I think the pandemic was the first time where we all, regardless of your comfort level with digital tech, we were all forced to use it, and we're all forced to kind of confront some of those fears and worries and things like that. And I think there were lots of anxieties around it. I've got two very young children, and we got through the pandemic, and obviously there were real concerns there, particularly for my daughter, who was, I think she was like 9 months when the pandemic hit. How is this going to impact her social development? Because we literally can't see anybody apart from on a screen. And there are some follow-on impacts from that, but I don't think it's too simplistic. It's too easy in a way to say, oh, it's because screens. There were all sorts of other things going on that impacted development there. And actually, screens were a great way of maintaining those relationships. So I have a very vivid memory that I will carry to my grave of my daughter's first birthday in lockdown. And my wife and I, my daughter, were sat around a table with a birthday cake for her, and there was a computer screen in front of her because that's the only way that we could have family around, and everybody sang happy birthday to her there. And it was lovely. She got to see everybody. She as she got older, she understood what this thing was because, we'd start, so you can start our conversations, start to talk these things through. And yeah, you see the benefits there instead of being worried that this is taking away from our social experiences. So I think in many ways, we worry that the social relationships that we form online are different or somehow not as good as the ones that we have offline. But they're the same ones. They're a way of maintaining them and enriching them.
Yeah, this is the thing, perhaps. And it is far too easy to say, oh, well, social media is wrecking my kid's life, or is, they're being bullied online, therefore get rid of screens. Because you need to have a communication with your networks, i.e. your relationships, are your friend relationships, or with your children. I've got goddaughters who are 12 and 16. That's an interesting age. If they have a problem with bullying on screen, they come to us and say, look, I'm being bullied, and we take action. So you cannot, I suppose, Pete, the thing is you cannot blame the technology, but what you've got to look at is using that as an almost like an add-on, and Elon Musk will be loving this, an add-on to your life, rather than saying that lives in a separate box from my real life. If you intertwine the twine, so you have real communication between yourselves and your friends and your business network, rather than just hiding behind a screen.
I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, that these things are very intertwined parts of our lives. And there's a very, kids do get bullied online. There are horrible things that happen online, and we very much need to deal with those sorts of things. But, and I understand that there's a very natural urge to go, well, let's ban or restrict it. Because, if it's not there, it's not having an impact, right? There's a few things to say about that. One is that, that's fine in principle, but it's not going to be the case that you ban these things for life. You don't, if you restrict kids' smartphone use until a certain age, then they will get one at a certain age. So those sorts of restrictions only work if you build really good digital literacy skills in the run-up to whatever age limit is. So I think I'm not in favor of like completely restricting everything just on its own. What I really would like to see is that, and kind of what you said there, like thinking about how we build better support networks for kids so that if they do come across something that has the potential to cause harm, they feel able and confident and open to talk to parents or caregivers. They have a support network around them so that they're able to shake that off, ideally. And that's part of the bit that's missing. The other thing is that there's very few instances of this where we've got research to back it up. But if you look at what happened in South Korea, for instance, about 10, 12 years ago, similar sort of worry. They worried that kids were spending too much time on the internet playing games, and this was impacting their sleep and therefore impacting their academic grades. So they introduced something called the shutdown policy, which is basically a curfew. Teenagers weren't allowed on the internet between midnight and 6 a.m. every night. And, simple problem, screens, a form of screen time is causing a form of problem, i.e. problems with sleep and academic achievement. Simple solution, ban it effectively, job done. It was about 6 or 7 years later where researchers started to look at the impact of this policy. And what they found from that was that the shutdown policy did improve kids' sleep. Kids on average were getting about a minute to a minute and a half more sleep per night. So yes, sleep went up, but not by much. Critically, what was happening though, that was that they were spending more time on the internet. They just shifted it to earlier in the day. So they sort of modified their behavior, and arguably that's going to be causing more of a problem overall. So on the face of it at the time, it looks like a simple solution that's very effective, but it has these unintended consequences that run counter to what you're actually trying to achieve. So that's what we need to think really carefully about this, because there are absolutely some important conversations about how we protect kids online, how we protect ourselves online and our own well-being, that they're not going to be solved by just like blanket bans in and of themselves. We need to think more deeply than that.
Well, maybe that's because we've fallen into this technology. It's been there. It's a bright, shiny thing. We've gone, oh, look, it, swipe left, it happens, yeah? Whereas we've never really thought about why we're engaging with it. And perhaps if you have a checklist about, because you see it. I mean, you go on public transport, you go into the park, you just see people on there. They're not there for any specific reason. They're just scrolling. They're just there. And perhaps if you think about why you need to go online, then this is going to be one of the reasons.
Yeah. Have you read my book? this is great. It's so nice to have this conversation, because I think very often, you know, this is a very emotive topic, right? And people have very strong feelings, and it can descend into a bit of argument and quite vitriolic debate at times. But I think we really need to move away from that. And thinking about it in these sorts of ways is really great. You're right. I mean, I remember getting my first iPhone in 2007, and I really remember going like, you know, this is great. This is awesome. What do I do with it? Mm. I just bought it because it was cool and not really thought about it. I can't remember when I signed up to WhatsApp or Twitter or Instagram. You know, they just happened. And then you sort of figure it out along the way. And I'm pretty sure that's what we all did, right? So, of course, we're in this situation where, because we've not thought about what this does for us or why we're engaging in it, that opens up risk for some of us, but not for others, depending on all sorts of other different factors that are going on in our lives. But we're at a point now where we need to think about this and go, okay, if something's not working for me, how can I fix that? It's not that I need to get rid of everything. It's just being more aware of your technology habits. I think so. Thinking about these as habit formation things is really important. Habits are neutral in and of themselves. They're not good or bad. They don't cause us harm or not in and of themselves. It's other things that create the goodness or the badness in that habit, right? So checking your phone lots in and of itself, not it's a neutral thing. Checking your phone just because you want to see what's been written on Twitter or whatever while you're driving down the road, super bad habit to get into, right? Checking your phone at night because you're feeling a bit lonely and you want to connect with friends, really great habit to be into, to get into. So if you start thinking about it in these sorts of ways, the important thing is it's not just the sheer amount of time you engage in a behavior, but it's if you're doing that in a non-reflective way, if you're doing it mindlessly and you're not thinking about how that behavior, that habit aligns with your goals, so short, you know, day-to-day goals, but even long-term goals, the more that happens, the more you open yourself up to something bad happening, a problematic episode. Even then, does that lead to harm or not? Demonstrable harm depends on all sorts of other things. You know, again, like what your situation is. Do you have pre-existing vulnerabilities? Do you have a good social network around you? Things like that. Can you talk to people about your experiences online? That's one of the really big things. But critically, if you can identify those bad habits, then you can start to do something about it, but keep good habits.
What do you hope that people will take from Unlocked?
I want people to feel a little bit more reassured that, you know, the science isn't settled on screen time yet, but that doesn't mean that there isn't anything to worry about. But I think we can be more targeted in our worries, and we can think about those in a way where we feel empowered to do something about it. I think a lot of the ways in which we talk about our screen use at the minute really disempower us. You know, this is very much the bad things are something that have happened to us without us knowing and beyond our control, and therefore it has to be somebody else to sort it out. And I definitely don't think that's the case. I think we have a lot of power in this space. And I think if we can think about this in a little bit more of a rational way, a little bit more of a sensible way, we can really start asking sort of deep, quite difficult questions of the tech industry, of ourselves, to make these things work better for us.
The book is called Unlocked, The Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better. It's by Professor Pete Etchells, who's been to you today. Pete, if people want to find you online, where do they go?
Everywhere, Twitter, Instagram. I'm Pete Etchells in most places. My website's PeteEtchells.com, so you can find most of my links there.
And you'll be able to order the book from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Unlocked. It's by Pete Etchells. Pete, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at coda.com.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.